This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo with Kevin Barrett, where you can catch the Boy Wonder here on Mondays and Fridays, and I'm here the rest of the week. My special guest today is an Episcopal priest and activist in New York City. He's well known for articles about the military-industrial complex that have appeared in magazines such as Covert Action Quarterly and Global Outlook. In 2003, he founded the campaign to demilitarize the police in New York City. His name is Frank Morales, and I've heard so many good things about this man, I had to have him on. Frank, welcome to the Dynamic Duo.
It's nice to be with you, Jim.
I've read a number of pieces of yours, and anyone I should mention can go on Google and just enter Frank Morales, M-O-R-A-L-E-S, and you'll find a lot of really good stuff, including some I'm going to talk about. One is entitled Ground Zero, another The Provocateur State, a third about U.S. military civil disturbance planning. And when you talk about disturbance, believe me, reading what Frank has to say is very disturbing in many different ways. Frank, I'd like to read just a paragraph from your piece about Ground Zero, which I found very affecting. When you were called to come down there to help out, you took an evening shift.
Yes.
And here you were talking about with a first responder who was really sick and spitting up blood and popping antibiotics, and how the wives of his friends buried somewhere beneath a burning toxic earth were calling him and asking him if he'd found their husbands. Recognizing that I was somewhat overwhelmed by the spectacle of devastation all around us, he said to me, "Father, you don't see any chairs or tables, no desks, do you? All you see is steel and earth. Look at the earth," he said. "The people are in it." As he said this, he motioned me to examine the soil that I was standing in. It was rich and moist, enriched with the ground-up bodies of the dead. My feet inside my boots began to tingle. At this point, recognizing that I had truly arrived in hell, I was moved to utter in his presence, possibly for his benefit, "Hey, that if I had somebody in this mess, I'd be pissed as shit. Yeah, I'd want to get those motherfuckers." At which point, he put his hand on my shoulder and whispered, "Hey, it's not about that. You want to know something?" Drawing near to my ear, "Bush and Bin Laden have the same banker."
Yeah.
Stunning.
And people have asked me, you know, "Frank, did he really say that?" And I assure you, everything I have in that piece is as it heard.
Frank, this is just so moving. I mean, there were 1,100 bodies that weren't recovered ever. Were no part of them.
The medical examiner's office here in New York lists the, because I was interested in looking at, and I'm not sure that it's been sufficiently examined, you know, the literal evidence of the bodies. In other words, exactly what happened to those people, and the medical examiner here in New York classifies those roughly 1,100 bodies, I think it's might slightly more than that, as vaporized.
Yes.
With the DNA of some of the people in the blood of some of the other people and so on and so forth. It didn't strike me at the time when I was there performing Last Rites, which is shortly after the bombings took place, but I soon became aware that it was not really feasible that these bodies would be vaporized with the mere collapse of the floors on top. You know, one logically, in common sense, would assume that that many people trapped underneath collapsing floors, you know, the great majority would wind up at the base of the building, that you wouldn't have this phenomena of people, and let alone chairs and desks and everything else being totally vaporized. So as I said, when I first was there, and I was struck with how little debris, relatively speaking, I mean, I expected 30 stories of debris, that everything seemed to be pulverized, and I was kind of struck that I was so overwhelmed with the devastation and so on and so forth that I really didn't factor in, as I have since, that these buildings certainly were not brought down simply as a result of jet fuel.
Yeah, that's a great point. In fact, Judy Wood, who is perhaps the leading expert studying what happened to the World Trade Center, has estimated that there ought to have been about 12.5% of the mass there in the rubble pile. For example, in Building 7, which was a 47-story building that, as you know, came down at 5:20 in the afternoon,
right,
having been hit by no planes and having no jet fuel fires. There were anywhere from 5 to 7 stories there, about 12% of a 47-story building. In the case of these 210-story buildings, however, they were basically reduced to ground level. It's absolutely stunning.
Yeah. The North Tower was referred to, when I was there, as a 2,000-degree pit because it wasn't even above ground. At that point, it was simply a pit. And the cherry picker, which was emblazoned with an American flag, which had an image of a Native American superimposed over the flag, just for historical accuracy's sake, on the cherry picker itself, was literally going down into the pit, which was very difficult because of the heat that was being generated from what I'd come to learn was molten steel at the base of this pit. You didn't even have, you know, in that case it was below ground level. So, I mean, I remember that quite vividly, and the comment that you read, I just wanted to bring out to people it was an honest rendition of what occurred there, but I tried to portray the emotions that anyone would go through. You know, I sat there and, you know, I came in to do that task, to do last rites, and you went through a sort of a series of concentric circles of security, including the National Guard people at the very end, and so on. And then when I was finally literally with the guys who were moving steel and traipsing around all of this debris, late at night, I just got this sense, like, man, this thing is really, you know, and yeah, I could see, you know, if I knew who did this, I'd really want to get him. I mean, I was kind of,
yeah.
But then I learned, and this was the lesson for me there, was that the prevailing ethic at that moment, and for a lot of people, and I know there were a lot of us who kind of weren't dealing on this revenge, let's go kill somebody kind of level, but they were as far removed from that as one could be, because when you were so close to that, when you could, you know, literally, as I said, the guys are walking around with 1-pound bags, little plastic seal-up red bags where they were collecting, you know, inch or less than inch pieces of body, or what they thought were pieces of body, and they're walking around picking these up with their hands, you lost the momentum to carry out, you know, that which was in front of you to somebody else. You didn't go there. You didn't. And this is what people don't understand. It's very easy to sit back, and if you're not immersed in that kind of killing, that kind of death, and wish it on someone else. But it's not that way when you're situated in it. There's a different kind of a logic that takes place there. So the lesson that I got from these guys was quite different. And it's a fact that this guy said to me, and another guy later on, I don't know if I put it in the piece, I may have said that, he was commenting about what was going on, and I was saying, yeah, this is like, wow, this is really destructive. He says, well, look, this is rich people fighting over the oil, and we're caught in the middle.
And we're caught in the middle. It's there indeed, Frank. Stand by. We'll be right back with my very special guest, Frank Morales. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Dynamic Duo. My special guest today was born in 1949 and grew up on the Lower East Side of Manhattan. His father was Puerto Rican and his mother Peruvian. He first became involved in politics after the assassinations of John F. Kennedy, Robert Kennedy, and Martin Luther King as a member of the Assassination Information Committee. His name is Frank Morales. Frank, it's just such a pleasure to have you on the show. As you may know, I have been deeply involved in research on the death of JFK myself.
Yes.
And it's quite clear, I think, that all three cases involved conspiracies. And I think in particular that J. Edgar Hoover was a constant factor across the board.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. No doubt.
Very sad, very tragic. I love the stuff you've written. Let me read a passage from the Provocateur State, which we can then discuss. The requirement of an ever-escalating level of social violence to meet the political and economic needs of the insatiable anti-terrorist complex is the essence of the new U.S. militarism. What is now openly billed as permanent war ultimately serves the geopolitical ends of social control in the interests of U.S. corporate domination, much as the anti-communist crusade of the now exhausted Cold War did. Back in 2002, following the trauma of 9/11, Secretary of Defense Donald H. Rumsfeld predicted there would be more terrorist attacks against the American people and civilization at large. But how could he be so sure? Perhaps because these attacks would be instigated on the orders of the Honorable Mr. Rumsfeld. According to Los Angeles Times military analyst William Arkin, writing on October 27, 2002, Rumsfeld set out to create a secret army, a super intelligence support activity network that would bring together CIA and military covert action, information warfare, intelligence, and cover and deception to stir the pot of spiraling global violence. Let's go back to your original statement here about the needs of social violence to satisfy the insatiable appetite or to feed it of anti-terrorism. It's very clear to me too, Frank, that you know after the demise of communism, the end of the Cold War, when the wall comes down, that there's a great need for the military-industrial complex to have some substitute, something that's going to justify the conveyor belt of massive armaments, weapons, and so forth that is going to continue to fill their coffers with gold. And nothing could be better than terrorism. Terrorism is so vague, so amorphous. Anything that happens anywhere in the world could be blamed on terrorists. And most conveniently, you can perpetrate terrorist acts yourselves and blame them on anyone you want. And who's going to be in the position to deny it?
Yes, it's part of the pathology of militarism that we learned from the days of Eisenhower, who talked about the deadly symbiosis between profit making and the armaments industries, and so forth. So we recognize now that this permanent war euphemism is a cover for this ongoing pathology in which you need to create situations that rationalize further military involvement and so on. But in addition to that, there are also strategic needs that are linked to the whole notion of counterinsurgency. Counterinsurgency, as brought to you by the Pentagon and so on, has as one of its requirements to split the mainstream. Take a situation like Iraq. You have an occupation. People can understand this from a common sense point of view. Your country is invaded. You have an occupation force. You have an insurgency, i.e. people who are willing and able to combat the occupation of your country. But in the middle, in the vast middle, you have people who are unable to do so, who are frightened and who may support the insurgency, but who are not directly involved in it, and so on. But you have the potential for the insurgency to grow. So counterinsurgency apparatus needs to have this population somehow neutralized so that they don't support the insurgency in order to defend the occupation. One of the ways to do that is to foment terrorist activity, is to blow things up, kill innocent people, and so on, and blame it on one of the factions of the insurgency. So you can create splits within the otherwise mainstream, if you will, population who's not involved in the insurgency, who doesn't necessarily support the occupation, so that they become confused, they become frightened. You create splits, and you create the notion in the minds of the public, which you see in the New York Times now, vis-a-vis Iraq, of a civil war. And the whole idea of that things are cut and dry, you have an invading, illegal, occupying army versus a domestic population becomes lost. you create this this kind of confusion. You allow for the stability of the occupation forces by way of fomenting this terrorism. So my guess is that a lot of the so-called Shiite versus Sunni versus Kurds versus so on versus the other, sure, there's going to be a certain amount of that, but it's like back in the days of the Panthers and the US organization in California, where the LAPD was running guns to both sides. They attempt to create division, military-style division and conflict within these center, these middle sectors, so that they don't become subject to the appeal of the insurgency, which is fighting a very clear-cut battle against an occupying army. So there's a long history of the use of terrorism, Operation Gladio in Western Europe in the 40s, to point the finger at the potential insurgencies and so forth, and confuse and disarm the people.
Well, I think if there's anything the Bush administration excels at, it's spinning, public relations, confusion, distraction. That is their area of expertise. I've not known them to solve any bona fide problem,
yeah,
but to engage in graft and corruption and payoffs and plant stories and pay for mercenary forces, which I expect, by the way, are performing a lot of the provocative actions you're describing that are being fabricated to create the impression of a Sunnis attacking Shia and vice versa.
There was an instance in Iraq where a couple of British soldiers, you might recall, were captured by the Iraqi police, if you will, who were trucking around town dressed up as so-called insurgents, blowing things up.
Yeah.
And they were apprehended by the Iraqi police, and of course the British military came in. Similar case in Los Angeles, and I like to keep bringing this back home,
so,
is that during the Rodney King affair...
Hold that thought, Frank. We'll be right back. We'll pursue it. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo, with my very special guest, Frank Morales. Stand by. My special guest today, according to Wikipedia, became an assistant pastor in 1978 in the Bronx. He worked with squatters. In one interview, he recalled, "I used to walk out of services with a crowbar and we'd open up abandoned buildings." He now works at St. Mark's Episcopal Church in the Bowery. Frank Morales, by name, welcome to the Dynamic Duo. And again, I want to say how glad I am to have you on.
Well, it's good to be with you.
Tell me more now about where we left off regarding these operations that the government was perpetrating to mislead others about what was going on.
Yes, well, what I've tried to get across is that the notion of provocateur, back in the 60s, I was involved in the peace movement on campuses like a lot of students, and at one point became aware of a gentleman who was going around. This is a guy who was talking, kind of militant, the kind of language, and souping up a lot of the young freshmen and sophomores that, the ROTC, the Army training facilities on the campuses needed to be blown up and this kind of thing. And he was successful in getting some freshmen to do that. He was showing students, dynamite, and he had little stashes of things. And eventually he was able to coax a couple of young students into doing that, and subsequently the anti-war movement activists on the campus were rounded up, and we had a trial and so forth. The surprising thing was that this person, who was part of our anti-war group, turned out to be an FBI agent provocateur. Now, most of us at that time were not familiar with even the phrase provocateur. We were not, do you mean to tell us that law enforcement actually gives you the dynamite and then busts you for doing it? I mean, this was not fair. This was like foreign to us. So the whole notion of provocateur, where you stimulate the involvement, where you create situations which necessitate the involvement of the military, the police, and so forth, or the repression, you bring it down, is promoted by law enforcement / military people. So I had that experience back then.
The notion
of a provocateur state is to broaden that concept to suggest that the pathology of militarism, more specifically, is to create situations around the world which necessitate military involvement, which split the mainstream within the population in an occupation situation, as I mentioned before, create situations where you can point fingers at this particular religious group or that particular religious group to destabilize the country, necessitate the involvement of an occupying force, which can then sell itself as a pacification force. We're here to make peace between these warring factions and this whole kind of thing. This is the strategy of the provocateur state. It's part of the pathology of militarism, this military-industrial complex which links profit-making to munitions. And this was also the case in L.A., during the so-called Los Angeles riots back in the early 90s around the Rodney King verdict, where Los Angeles police, where the National Guard, the Los Angeles police busted again a car, and which was full of National Guard's people that had all this dynamite and stuff that they were planting and blowing up all around Los Angeles. That people, well, why did the people burn down their own city and this kind of thing? We need to realize that there are elements out there, whether it's special operations people in Iraq, whether it's special operations people in L.A., who are about creating terrorist situations. The World Trade Center in 1993 with Ahmad Salem, facilitating the transfer of the munitions that were required to use to blow up the World Trade Center at that point. These are inside jobs. And the important point for the American people to recognize is this is not only about rationalizing war making, the profits and the seizure, the grabbing of land and resources around the world and various political motives and so forth, but it also necessitates and requires repression at home. Because what happens is that when you have these kinds of agendas, it requires that the same people who are planning to invade Iraq and who are now fomenting plans around Iran and other places need to create an apparatus to repress dissent at home, because they recognize that their agenda will engender reaction at home. So you have a dialectic between the kind of provocateur that happens abroad and the kinds of situations that we see here. So that, for instance, Bush's plan to move towards martial law in the recent Defense Authorization Act, where the Insurrection Act was rewritten to allow Bush to station troops anywhere in the country he wants without the consent of local governors, local National Guard people, local police authorities, is part and parcel of that whole process. They create these terrorist actions in order to panic the people, create an atmosphere of fear, so that once they feel that they can get away with the kind of repression at home that they've been doing in this country, stripping people of habeas corpus rights and so on and so forth, that's what we're seeing now. So it's all part and parcel of what I refer to as the provocateur state, the provocateur nature of militarism both abroad and at home.
Well, I think your analysis is completely brilliant. I'm really quite fascinated by what you've written. I want to encourage everyone to track down the article where you outline this, The Provocateur State. Do a Google search on it. And remember, provocateur, P-R-O-V-O-C-A-T-E-U-R, The Provocateur State. Because I think you're exactly right, Frank. I think you're exactly right. Now,
that particular article pointed out the existence of a document that was made public that was written by the Defense Science Board, which is Donald Rumsfeld's former defense secretary. It's the defense Pentagon's one of their kind of think tanks, and the document refers to what was termed the Proactive Preemptive Operations Group, or P2OG. Which would actually carry out secret missions designed to provoke terrorist groups into committing violent acts. This P2OG, which was a 100-member so-called counter-terrorist organization, had a $100 million a year budget, and their function was to orchestrate missions designed to, quote, stimulate reactions among terrorist groups. So in other words, translating that, this is a group that would actually do terrorist action in order to create a situation where one group would be then targeting the other group and so on, the kind of thing that we're seeing in Iraq right now. It was in Iraq. This is the kind of thing that was used in El Salvador. It was actually referred to in an article in the New York Times a couple of years back as the Salvadorization of Iraq, to create an environment of terror brought to you by the Pentagon Incorporated in order to split and confuse the population so that the clear-cut occupying force versus the domestic population and its insurgency would become confused and would in some way contribute to a counterinsurgency strategy that these people are attempting to carry out.
Not to mention, of course, the false impressions conveyed to the American people through reporting, even if it's accurate at the superficial level. Obviously, it's ignoring the deeper truths of what's actually going on here, which is precisely the effect that they intend. Stand by. We'll be right back with my special guest, Frank Morales. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo. Hey, I wish I knew it was going to be all right. My special guest today, Frank Morales, is an Episcopal priest and activist in New York City. He is known for his articles on the military-industrial complex published by magazines such as Covert Action Quarterly and Global Outlook. And in 2003, he founded the Campaign to Demilitarize the Police in New York City. Frank, well, I want to emphasize, you know, most of our discussion on the provocateur state and military civil disobedience planning and all that, our earlier conversation about the, you know, ground zero and so forth has provoked some questions from listeners. And in particular, I have several here about the jumpers. And one inquirer asks how many jumpers you think there were, why you think they may have jumped when they started jumping, whether or not there was a constant rate through the 102 minutes that the North Tower was standing, and did you see any from the South Tower? That's several questions.
You know, I don't have a lot to add to that. I don't recall hearing too much about that. The only thing that I recall noticing on my way there were clothing and signs of people strewn on fire escapes blocks away.
Strewn on fire escapes blocks away.
Yeah, suggesting that people were literally blown out of there.
Blown out of the buildings and onto fire escapes blocks away and so forth. But rooftops too, presumably, and so forth.
Yeah, but quite a distance away, and people when I was on my way down to the World Trade Center, I remember being struck because there was a building that were some police around it, and they were looking up at it was just a 6-story building, and in some of the fire escapes were draped some clothing.
Huh.
And I remember being struck then. I think an area, you know, I've suggested this before to other 9/11 research people, is to really get down with the medical examiner people and query from a medical point of view is what would be required to vaporize 1,200 bodies?
Yeah.
Because, you know, it strikes me, I think it was David Lifton who wrote a book years ago on the Kennedy assassination called Best Evidence, that the bodies, in the case of 9/11, could be some of the best evidence for the manner in which those buildings came down.
Yes, yes. The buildings that have been pulverized.
Yes. But as far as jumpers go, I don't recall too much about that when I was there at the time. Again, what I remember mostly was being struck with the lack of debris. And I remember asking. I said, "Where are the desks? Where are the computers? Where is everything?"
Yeah.
And of course, at that moment, I was not as aware as I am now about the fact that that jet fuel alone couldn't have brought these buildings down. And even if you had this kind of collapsing pancake theory, which I know has since been discarded as even the official story, you would have a lot of remnant there. And it was very clear, and I can testify to the fact that having been there immediately following, that everything was just dust. I mean, things were just, this isn't going to happen in the simple case of a building kind of falling down on itself. You know?
Yeah. In Mexico, I was in Mexico, in 1957, I guess, or 58, and coming out, the great earthquake occurred in Mexico City, and of course, there were lots of buildings that were collapsed, but people were crushed. I mean, the bodies existed. They may have had craniums that were, you know, pulverized, but I mean, the bodies were intact.
Right. We didn't find, in fact, when I was asked to go down to ground zero by the cathedral here in New York, and they suggested to me then, because they had been given the word in advance, that don't expect to find bodies. And so, you know, and as I said, people were walking around with these small plastic bags. So, you know, it, right from the very beginning, the condition of the people, I realize, a rather kind of gory focus. But it strikes me as that anyone in their right mind would look at this and say, wait a minute, there's a lot more going on here than floors collapsing down upon people. You don't vaporize 1,200 people through collapsing floors.
Didn't it strike you as peculiar when they said, don't expect to find bodies?
Yeah.
And, of course, there's a stunning amount of paper. I mean, there's tons of paper scattered throughout New York. And the fact that, you know, the bodies, the desks, the chairs, the computers, and human beings and other living things are all pulverized and the paper isn't,
exactly.
You know, leads to lots of speculation about what could do this. I'm inclined to think water content may be one consideration. You know, water, it can be instantly turned into steam and expands like 1,600 times and could do a tremendous amount of damage. But I have to leave it to persons more expert than I, such as Judy Wood, to offer a more definitive explanation.
Yeah.
But paper appears to have a virtually zero water content, which may possibly be why it might have survived and other things not. But something very, very strange was going on.
Yeah.
And it's fascinating that it struck you that way immediately, because I think it would, given your perceptivity and intellect, that you would sort this out.
Yeah. It was the most obvious thing when you arrived there. That and the heat. The heat, particularly in the North Tower. Again, the guys were referring to it. It was a 2,000 degree pit, and the cherry picker could barely get down there because of the heat that was emanating from below.
I'm even surprised it could still function, that the hydraulics wouldn't seize up.
Yeah, as I said, I tried to get across in that piece, it was like being in Dante's Inferno. Every time they moved some steel, flames would come shooting through. It was horrendous. And the signs that that there was something other than simple jet fuel become obvious in hindsight, but I can certainly testify to what I saw at that time.
Well, as other questions arise, I may interject them. In the meanwhile, however, observing your writing about the provocateur state, I must say in my research on JFK, I found all the stuff about Operation Northwoods quite fascinating. James Bamford's book, Body of Secrets, of course, discusses it, where apparently Eisenhower was so upset about Castro coming to power that he talked with Lyman Lebnitzer, the Army general who was then the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, that if they didn't have legitimate reasons for attacking Cuba, they should invent some.
Right.
You picked up on that theme here. Well, you mention, let me just read this paragraph. Witness the U.S. Joint Chiefs' discussion of Operation Northwoods back in 1962, a plan to blow up U.S. assets, including U.S. citizens, in order to justify an invasion of Cuba. Later, U.S. Army Field Manual 30-31B, entitled Stability Operations Intelligence, Special Fields, dated March 18, 1970, and signed by General William C. Westmoreland, promoted terrorist attacks and the planting of false evidence in public places, which were then to be blamed on communists and socialists. It called for the execution of terrorist attacks throughout Western Europe, carried out through a network of covert U.S. NATO armies in order to convince European governments of the communist threat.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a long history of this tactic. That's why I tried to make it clear, you know, in my earlier remarks that, you know, as simple as an individual, this person in upstate New York who was known as Tommy the Traveler, who gave dynamite to people, the situation in L.A., in Baghdad with the British soldiers, to higher scale efforts. It's a provocateur state. It's a provocateur mentality. Split the opposition. Point the finger elsewhere. Take the focus off the real problem.
And the more I learn about it, the more nauseated I become. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo, with my very special guest, Frank Morales. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo with Kevin Barrett, where you can catch the Boy Wonder here on Mondays and Fridays, and I'm here the rest of the week. My special guest was born in 1949 and grew up on the Lower East Side of Manhattan. His father was Puerto Rican and his mother Peruvian. He first became involved in politics after the assassination of JFK, RFK, and MLK as a member of the Assassination Information Committee. For which I commend him greatly. Frank, let me ask, you mentioned about the agent provocateur on a college campus, but I wasn't sure I caught exactly the years or the campus on which that was taking place.
Yeah, this was in upstate New York. It was at the Hobart College campus in Geneva, New York. In 1968-69, during those years. And he was known as Tommy the Traveler.
This is quite fascinating because I graduated from Princeton in 62 and took my commission in the Marine Corps and then resigned in 66 as a captain to pursue graduate work in the history and philosophy of science at Indiana. But my wife and I divorced about the time I finished my second year and got my master's, and I went to Columbia for 68-69 and got SDS had been very successful the year before and causing a lot of problems on the campus, and I got involved in a group called Students for Columbia University. And I mean, in a way, I was viewing them as standing between me and my PhD. And I remember one day in the fall, this was the most interesting event, when they had rushed the military recruiting center, or so they thought, but it turned out to be the educational placement center, and that I was standing in the middle of the campus, you know, in front of Butler with a bullhorn, announcing to the campus what had happened. A group of them rushed at me to take away the bullhorn. A group of my friends came up, and the melee that ensued was actually captured in footage that CBS played at the end of the year, you know, as a wrapping up.
Right.
But what's important about it is the fellow who was the head of this little organization, the Students for Columbia University, had a very different demeanor from any student. He wore a suit. He had a very businesslike approach. And in retrospect, it has become obvious to me that this guy actually was working for the FBI. He was an agent. I have absolutely no doubt about it, Frank.
Yeah, we were totally unaware. This person had fraternized with us for a good period of time, and it was always pushing these kinds of actions, and at one point convinced a couple of freshmen to bomb the ROTC, which they did. It was a big, you know, one night the people were knocking on the dorms the doors and say the ROTC is on fire and so on and so forth. Long story short, they rounded up all the leadership of the student mobilization groups against the Vietnam War, and we had a trial, and in walks Tommy in a suit, and he's sitting with the FBI guys, and it was like our mouths dropped.
Yeah.
We were completely, as I tried to portray it, we were not, I didn't even know the meaning of the term provocateur.
Yeah.
You know, we didn't think that law enforcement does this kind of thing. But I use that just as sort of as an early example, and my contention is that the militarism in this period is a provocateur apparatus. They're set up to provoke for economic reasons. Obviously, you can't sell munitions and you can't sell missiles and guns and so forth and so on if you don't have a situation that necessitates those. So there's a logic to that, and it's kind of an industrial logic.
Yeah.
But the thing is that when we're at 9/11. Biggest provocateur action maybe in the history of the planet to create the context not only for, this plunder abroad and the killing of innocents and so forth, but also allows for a kind of strategy of tension at home so that the repression, the stripping away of our rights, the move towards martial law, the creation of detention centers through Halliburton just received a $386 million contract from the Army Corps of Engineers to build these detention centers. This is what's happening on our front, on the home front.
Yeah, I want to pursue that. I just mentioned in retrospect that, my sympathies today lie so much more with SDS than they even did with Students for Columbia University. I mean, I think the United States had no business being in Vietnam whatsoever, picking up on a French colonial war, and it's quite evident to me the real reason was never even presented to the American people. In 1968, I'll never forget a half-an-hour program, Walter Cronkite narrated, and he displayed a map of the offshore continental shelf, and he explained how all the big multinational companies had divvied it all up in the expectation that there were tremendous oil resources there. That's the one and only time I had a reasonable explanation for what we were doing in Vietnam.
Right. It's really tragic to me that, you know, people, particularly young men and these days young women, whose motivations are pure, they envision that what it is they're doing when they enlist or and so on is to fight for a certain set of values that they believe in and are worth upholding and so on, who are being manipulated, who are this whole notion that, you know, they can pay off the generals, and they can pay off these munitions companies, and they can just pour umpteen billions into Halliburton and Cheney and all the rest of these guys. They can't get these kids armor. You know, they can't get these kids medical care when they come home.
Yeah, it's ridiculous.
You know, someday these young people are going to realize the what it is that's been done to them, and this administration and other like administrations are going to have hell to pay when those kids come of age and gain an awareness.
You may know there's legislation pending now in the Congress to deprive any American veterans who have suffered from post-traumatic stress syndrome the right to bear arms, to own firearms, and I think this is a part and parcel of the effort to de-weaponize the American citizens. I mean,
the war on terror, the so-called war on terror, is on one level, and I've written about this, a war on dissent. I've written about Operation Garden Plot, which is the Pentagon's contingency plan. It's long term. It's kind of a work in progress to suppress dissent in America, utilizing military assets within a so-called operations other than war doctrinal framework. But really, deeper than the war against dissent is when you really get right down to it, the war on terrorism, understood in the terms that I'm putting forth here, is really a preemptive attempt to suppress the potential within America for an armed insurgency. Now, I say that as a person who's committed to nonviolence, who is not about, suggesting, promoting for all of those who, unsavory characters who might be listening in. This is not what I'm advocating. But the logic of the war on terror as a war against dissent is a war against the potential for the American people to create the context for a new American revolution. And let's face it. Revolutions are not always nonviolent. Revolutions can and have been subject to the use of force. And the ability of this administration to foment its agenda from this point on into the future requires a population at home that is passive, that is pacified, and particularly that is disarmed. Not only disarmed in terms of information, analysis, ideology, and so on and so forth, but disarmed materially. Because without those, the ability to defend yourself, you're exactly that, you're defenseless.
Let's come back to that crucial issue. My special guest, Frank Morales. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo. My special guest today, Frank Morales, is an Episcopal priest and activist in New York City. Frank, did you go to school in New York, too, where you grew up?
Yeah, I went to school here on the Lower East Side until I was about 15, and then I received a scholarship through the Boys Club here to attend private school. So I was actually kind of shipped off to private school in Massachusetts for 4 years up there, so I had kind of the Fresh Air Fund experience here, where I was granted the opportunity, and it was an opportunity to go to a private school. You know, I grew up in the Jacob Reef housing projects here on Lower East Side.
Was it Andover?
No, it was Cushing Academy.
Well, I got to say, you know, you write wonderfully. Your knowledge is excellent. You're obviously a very knowledgeable fellow. I say you must be very dedicated to research.
Well, I got involved in this whole question of domestic operations of the Pentagon. People ask me, what are you focusing on? Because, you know, there's a lot of areas that one can focus on. And I got involved in this actually through housing. I was, you know, I early on was involved in the squatter movement here, which is about, you know, we had a lot of abandoned buildings in the South Bronx. People are familiar throughout the country with these vast areas that were abandoned and so on and so forth. Anyway, long story short, I was interested in looking at the roots of homelessness, the roots of the conditions that I was seeing around the country. And I recognized that in the Kerner Commission report, which is a report that deals with civil disorder. In 1968, the federal government, following the so-called riots in Detroit and various other places around the country, put a commission together called the Kerner Commission, the Federal Commission on Civil Disorder in America, and they issued a report. And Chapter 17 of that report, which deals with housing. Now, you have to open up your mind here now and mix up a few categories here, because this is a commission dealing with civil disorder, dealing with riots in the urban centers. Chapter 17 of the Kerner Commission report deals with housing. And what the recommendations were for dispersal of concentrations of urban populations in order to prevent future riots, because President Johnson's executive order dealt with not only the causes of the riots, but ways in which prevent riots in the future. And one of the things that they suggested in that report, in Chapter 17, which dealt with housing, was to disperse the urban centers. And one of the phrases that was used by HUD, Housing and Urban Development at that point, was a phrase known as spatial deconcentration. Spatial deconcentration, which is a euphemism for what we now nowadays these days is planned shrinkage, the whole notion of emptying out urban centers of potentially troublesome poor people in order to prevent so-called civil disorder, in order to prevent the kinds of organizing and resistance that poor and working class people might tend to move towards. So I got interested in that at that point, but it was interesting that spatial deconcentration was lifted from a military manual. So I began to see the connections between militarism at home, particularly in the area of spatial deconcentration and creating these vast, quote-unquote, bombed-out areas in places like the South Bronx, and this whole question of homelessness and so on. Then, when FEMA was set up in 1979 in Washington, D.C., they were charged with overseeing the shelter system around the country, which they still do. They treat homeless people as within the context of emergencies, and the shelter system across the country, which, to be honest with you, is a low-intensity detention center. A lot of these homeless shelters, your barracks. I don't know if people are familiar with what goes on in large urban centers. You have these giant armories with cots, hundreds of them, where the incidence of AIDS and TB and so on and so forth is twice what it is on the street, and there are video surveillance cameras everywhere, and you go in, leave at 7 in the morning, you come back in at 9, and you don't have a cot, these kinds of things. FEMA oversees these nationally. So this represented to me a strategy coming out of the 60s in which, you know, you had the Black Panthers and the Young Lords and various other groups organizing in the urban centers around health, around schools and housing and so forth. A strategy to demobilize and disorganize them had to do with attacking the base, attacking the housing. reconcentrating those people, if you will, who had been dispersed in these control centers known as homeless shelters.
Several points you're making are stunning to me for a whole variety of reasons. Number one is you're talking about the American Army planning operations against the American people, and that this has been systemic, longstanding, and evidently rather thorough and painstaking. To me, that's a devastating indictment of where we stand.
Yeah, well, the institutionalization of the Northern Command in 2002. The U.S. now has a domestic military command, NORTHCOM, which was set up in 2002, although preparations for it precede 9/11. The euphemism Homeland Defense, I wrote a piece on Homeland Defense in 1999, because that euphemism was already being bandied around the Pentagon in the context of civil disturbance planning, in the context of dealing with rebellion. The NORTHCOM exists, in its actuality, exists as to execute operations within America. Well, I wrote a piece called, The Pentagon Declares War on America. That's not simply rhetoric. These operations are being orchestrated within America under the heading of operations other than war. It's a doctrinal formulation which they came up with to rationalize military involvement within America, the use of non-lethal weapons, which are media-friendly, against protests, rubber bullets and wooden bullets and gases and electromagnetic pulse weaponry, which is now being used in Iraq, which is a microwave weapon. These are real. They exist, and they're designed to be used against noncombatants and civilians. So in any case, I got interested in the whole question of militarism on the home front, if you will. Later on, the militarization of the police, the creation of SWAT, which grew out of Army Combat Command in the early 70s, the transfer technology, technology transfers from Department of Defense to the Department of Justice, this whole question of the militarization of the police and what that represented. In other words, when we see SWAT, the militarization of the police, proliferation of non-lethal weapons, we have to ask why. Why are they arming domestic military forces against the American people? What are they preparing for?
Why are they training the police to operate as though they were a military unit?
Exactly. And now we're looking at the privatization in terms of Blackwater, and the real danger is that we could be facing in privatization of local police forces.
Stand by. We'll be right back with my special guest, Frank Morales. Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo. My special guest today is Frank Morales, who's an Episcopal priest and activist in New York City. Frank, this conversation raises at least two important issues in my mind. One is I've always assumed that the United States was largely free from tyrannical government because of the strength of our military, the existence of our National Guard, police forces, militias, the fact that 90% of our homes have firearms. And I look around today and I find that the military forces are being broken and depleted by these ongoing interventions in Iraq and Afghanistan, that the National Guard has been placed directly under the control of the President of the United States, even though that was opposed by all 50 governors of the states, that the police force and hunters and the militias appear to be being deprived of ammunition. I have reports now that the police forces around the country are having to resort to paint guns in order to perform target practice. And other reports are telling me ammunition is drying up, and I can't think of a more ingenious plan to render most of those weapons relatively ineffectual than to deprive us of ammunition.
Yeah, it strikes me that when, as I was mentioning before, when you really get to the bottom of what it is that, this administration has in store, and recognize that, what it is that they would be thinking, which is to create a passive population that is incapable of resistance. There are lots of historical lessons. The American Revolution is one. You need to disarm the population. You need to create situations where those entities of force, whether they're National Guard, local militias, police departments, and so forth, who may in fact be loyal to their own, so to speak, are disarmed, sufficiently disarmed so that they can't resist, the encroachment of federalized forces or as I mentioned earlier, the potential for private forces that are brought in. This is becomes a dangerous situation, and I think that's I think you're right. I don't think it's a mistake or an oversight on the part of you know, law enforcement munitions industries to deprive these forces of this of these munitions. I think it's part of a strategy of creating the context where Bush the executive can move in certain areas. Move National Guard people around, maybe private forces around, and run things from the top.
I've had two kinds of reports. One is that Halliburton has been buying up small manufacturers of ammunition. The other has been that all the ammunition has always come from large defense-oriented manufacturers, and it's very easy for the federal government to turn off the spigot.
Well, that could be. I haven't personally done enough research on that. To know, but I wouldn't think that the bulk of these weapons, you know, have historically come from the military. It's only recently, as far as I understand, that the kinds of military transfers and even the it's not so much a legislative thing. There's a memorandum of understanding that took place under Clinton with Janet Reno, which kind of codified some of these military transfers from the Department of Defense to the Justice Department.
Yeah.
So I would suggest that it's still more likely that these private companies and so forth are subject to being swallowed up by the Halliburtons that have a very distinctly political agenda.
Much of the outsourcing of the, you know, of the military, which is like shattering military integrity. I mean, yeah, an example I've used is very trivial. Is suppose you outsource the contract to mow the Pentagon lawn, and one day the contractor doesn't show up. What do? Sue him?
Right.
I mean, this is completely ridiculous. Armies have to be capable of handling all the functions they require on their own. What if the Halliburton, which has a contract to feed our troops, you know, they're actually feeding them garbage, but to feed them food out there, decides it's too hazardous, so they don't show up. What's that
exactly
mean? You're going to let your troops starve? This is insanity, and it's all motivated politically by the desire to have a low count when we talk about actual combat troops there. So Bush today can talk about, say, there being 130,000 U.S. troops there, when there are, in addition to that, something on the order of 180,000 privatized mercenary forces like Blackwater. So we actually have over 310,000 combat forces in Iraq.
Exactly. I think this is the manipulation of the, if you can put it in those terms, of the American military, cuts a lot of different ways. I was mentioning to a friend the other day that there was a piece that was circulating around the Pentagon some time ago called the Military Coup of 2012. Have you seen this piece?
No.
It was it's authored by a gentleman named Charles Dunlap, D-U-N-L-A-P. It was written back in the mid-90s, I think. And he wrote it. He's a retired colonel, I think, at this point. He wrote it for the Army War College, and long story short, it won the first place for a literary prize at the War College, and it's interesting because it's a 30-page fictional piece, you know, ostensibly fictional, but it utilizes actual historical data. So it talks about, for instance, that the piece basically opens up with a General Brutus, I think his name is, who's in jail, who's recounting what occurred in this is in 2012, what occurred some years earlier to bring about this military coup. So he's looking back, and he notes the passage of certain legislation under Clinton, and he talks a bit about some other things. So there's it's that kind of a piece.
Yeah.
But it's very interesting because it's two things. Intrinsic to the piece is the notion that the military grew tired of having to orchestrate these domestic missions, you know, busting marijuana plants and involving itself in, suppressing the rights of the citizens, disarming local populations, and so on and so forth. And that was the rationale for this coup, which is very interesting. But the other, so you can look at the piece, you know, as a piece of literature, and look at it in terms of what it's about, intrinsic to its, you know, as a literary product. But in addition to that, the piece functioned within the military such that it began to spawn conversations within the halls of the Pentagon around this whole question of military coup. And that is an interesting thing in and of itself. This one report I read where some general was saying, you know, things that heretofore would only be whispered behind closed doors are now being talked about openly. So I think that what we're, the potential for, you know, dissent within the military, you know, needs to be looked at, if not encouraged, so that the utilization on the part of the elite of the military, because remember, you know, the generals, the troops don't necessarily walk around with lots of money in their pocket. They're brought into these corporate boards, and I think C. Wright Mills analyzed it in The Power Elite, and this whole relationship between the corporate elite and the military elite, and how that, you know, how power in America really works. I think we need to be aware that the military itself is, like any institution, is subject to internal contradictions, and is subject to people resisting these trends. And I think that's something that we need to look forward to and encourage. I mean, there's no reason to suggest that, you know, we might as well toss in the towel because they're going to send these troops into our local communities and tell us what to do. But there's a lot of contradictions within all of this, and I think one last piece is interesting in that respect.
Yeah. We'll come right back to that. This is my special guest, Frank Morales. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo. My special guest today has been Frank Morales, an Episcopal priest and activist in New York City. Frank, I'm going to have you back. You're an encyclopedia of knowledge about some of the most pressing issues confronting this nation today. I must say, just two thoughts I had. One is how the militarization, you know, privatization of the military is damaging in more ways than one. I mean, it not only rips asunder the integrity of a military entity, and I think a lot of the people doing these, making these decisions, never had any military experience and therefore don't understand the nature, the organic necessity of a self-dependent military entity on the one hand. So they're not only destroying the functional integrity of the military, but the financial cost is exorbitant. I mean, you know, the studies have shown that having private outfits administer Social Security, for example, runs an overhead of 12 to 14%, while having the bureaucracy do it, it's only 2 to 4, and that 10% represents profit. When you have, you know, big contracts going to Halliburton, and they outsource it to KGB and all this other stuff, it goes on down, and everyone's trying to get their 10%, so it makes it fantastically expensive. So they're also breaking the bank. Now, that doesn't seem to bother this administration, but it should matter to any American who cares about, you know, the fiscal integrity, the military strength, and the moral standing of their nation, which of course has been completely hopelessly squandered by this administration. They've taken us from being the most respected and admired nation in the world to being the most despised and reviled. It's a complete disgrace, and anyone who thinks these people are going to give up their power willingly really doesn't understand the nature of the beast.
Yeah, precisely. It's money means nothing to these people, and when it comes to, you know, social control, making profits and for themselves and so forth. I mean, the ultimate patriotic act, you know, these days is to remove these people, is to do everything we can to take this country back. You know, there's lots of creative, thoughtful people around this country. We don't have a monolithic ideological nation. There's a lot of divergence in points of view and vision and so forth. But we can work with that. But what we can't work with is the kind of you know, rampant brutality and violence that is being done in our name, and also being done to our own people.
Yeah, that diversity and outlook and point of view is always a part of what made this country great.
I mean, exactly.
Freedom of speech, freedom of religion, freedom of the press. You know, this other thing about when you're talking about dispersal of populations, Bob Petraeus, who was a candidate for governor in Ohio, is in a celebrated investigative journalist. He's published 13 books and won 13 awards. Has, among others, a book on Star Wars weather mods and full spectrum dominance, where he talks about the capacity of the military to affect affect the weather, and a lot of us believe that this Hurricane Katrina was deliberately developed into a Class 5 hurricane in order to bring about devastation to Louisiana, you know, to New Orleans.
Well,
and part of it fits exactly your scenario of dispersing that black population.
Yeah, I don't have a lot of we don't have a lot of time to get into it right now, but I've written a piece on New Orleans, which I haven't published, basically because I keep working it. But the long and the short of it is I've gotten a weather execution order that was issued by the Pentagon prior to Katrina, which is very interesting. It needs analysis. I don't quite know what to make of it. But in terms of that, and we know that the weather modification and so forth, you know, I can show you reams of stuff coming out of various sectors of the Pentagon on all of that, and I'm sure the person you referred to talks about that. I think it's very clear that at this point, from my point of view, you had a military expo, a Gulf Coast Military Expo in New Orleans in May, 2 months prior to Katrina, in which were gathered representatives of the military, Homeland Defense, the Council on Foreign Relations in the downtown, I think it was the Hilton Hotel in New Orleans, where they were discussing so-called land gaps in Homeland Defense in the Gulf, and what constituted Homeland Defense in the Gulf area. Now, needless to say, they weren't talking about the needs of the people who were living there, who, as we know, are predominantly poor, working-class people. They were talking about the defense of the oil. The whole question of what happened in New Orleans is tied inextricably to two things. One is maintenance of security of the oil. The Louisiana offshore oil port is the only place in the country where the supertankers come in, period. The lines run underneath areas like the Ninth Ward. When the oil is coming in there, the Gulf Coast Military Expo of that year, Governor Blanco laid out in very stark terms, saying only 18 miles off the shore of New Orleans is the Louisiana offshore oil port. We have to defend this against terrorist activity and so on and so forth. She called for the creation of a regional homeland security base. Don't forget, New Orleans is home to major military installations and contractors like Boeing and Northrop and so on. They're all there. They are looking to develop. So in short, New Orleans, the devastation, it's about gentrification. It's about the Disneyfication of New Orleans. It's about, you know, the old-fashioned Negro removal.
Taking property from the poor and giving it to the rich.
But it's also about it's a counter-terrorist overlay. Francis Fragos Townsend out of the National Security Council, who is the counter-terrorist person, she was designated the point person to oversee New Orleans. There's a lot more going on there that has to do with the creation of a military base in that region. And for my money, that's where it's going.
Yeah,
there'll be the inevitable Disneyfication and all that sort of thing that's going on there, moving the people out, creating FEMA shelters and so on and so forth. The same FEMA's overlooking the shelter system around the country. That's what they do. They don't manage emergencies, you know, in the interest of the people. They're there to quarantine, to detain, to so-called shelter. That's what they're set up to do. That's what they've been set up to do. They had nothing, you know, and turn away aid that was coming in, as we all know.
It was stunning. It was an
insidious
absolutely stunning
thing there. But that's a military operation going on in New Orleans. And whether or not the levees, in fact, I read a report yesterday of another report of some people who claim to have heard explosions of the levees and so forth. We know that some of the levees were blown up. We know that already because there are various mainstream reports of people saying that they were informed. People came around and told them to get out of there because the levees were going to be blown up. Some of the levees, this is not very well known. There's issues of explosives and so forth regarding some of the levees, but some of it was made available to the people. They were told to leave because these were going to be blown. It's sort of akin, in a sense, to this whole anomaly, these anomalies around World Trade Center 7, where people were told the building was coming down. In other words, you can't always keep it all tight and closed and so on. The word gets out, and the word got out in New Orleans that these things were going to blow. And there's a lot of that, but the macro on this whole thing is this whole look in this area to create a military installation to defend against terrorist activity. And even from their point of view, it makes a certain amount of sense. Think about it. We're going to invade Iran. The supertankers only come in to that port. That's it. That's where they come. That's where they're headed. If you don't think that they have a vested interest in securing that landmass, then it's irrational. This is what it's about.
Is the attack on Iran also going to precipitate vast protest here that will justify their enforcing, you know, mechanisms of suppression, suspending the Constitution, and putting you and me and others like us in these
sure.
detention facilities?
Yeah, I mean, that is the logic of it. That's the way they're moving. It doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure out the way they move. We can expect some other kind of provocative action on a large scale. And, you know, the concurrent attempt to use that action to repress us even further. But I think the American people are hip to this now, and there's more of us than them.
Frank, I can't thank you enough, and I look forward to having you back very soon. I hope our next conversation is not in one of those facilities. It's been a great privilege to have Frank Morales as my special guest today. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Dynamic Duo. Thank you all for listening.